Welcome to Tech Central's Meet the CIO, which is brought to you by NTT Data, where global experience meets local impact. My name is Duncan McLeod, and I am editor of Tech Central. Now, I'm on the garden route today, and my guest, I think, is in Cape Town. He is Group CITO at banking giant Absa. And Johnson Idaso is his name. Johnson, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Johnson has held senior positions at various large organizations, including Old Mutual, where he was Group CIO, but he's also held leadership positions at the insurance giant Aviva and at AstraZeneca. I'm really looking forward to this discussion today because there is a lot happening in the world of banking when it comes to technology. Johnson, thank you for making the time to talk to Tech Central on Meet the CIO. It must be a very interesting time to be the head of technology at a major bank. What's keeping you busy at the moment?
At a macro level, so it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Duncan, for having me. And yes, I am in Cape Town. We've passed the storms. We've survived the storms earlier in the week.
Oh, it was terrible.
They were the worst I've experienced probably in my 11 years in Cape Town, all jokes aside. But anyway, we're grateful, that we've survived and the city's recovering. What's top of mind at the moment? Of course, it's AI. Isn't that what is keeping all of us? And AI in all its forms, on the one dimension is just the rate of change in artificial intelligence. Clearly, I'm talking generative AI, agentic AI. And obviously, I spend a lot of time with the big frontier AI firms, as you would expect. You can see them maturing into industries like financial services and pharmaceuticals, because clearly those are both very regulated industries, very, very important that technology is used very responsibly. Then, of course, the other side of AI is, of course, cyber criminals are becoming adept at using AI. So that's why I say probably AI would be the big overarching topic. I do say internally in Absa, it's transformative technology, so let me not belittle it. But we need to remember it is technology, it is a tool, and one has to understand how to use this technology in support of your business strategy. So there is, again, a danger of, it's AI, AI, AI. But if you don't understand why you're using it, for what purpose, how it's actually enabling the delivery of your customer promises and your business strategies, and of course, like any technology, you could be disappointed. But AI is clearly a big, big area. How will it impact customer expectations? The opportunity on the African continent. One of the things we think a lot about, for instance, is let's be honest, for AI, you need AI data centers, AI factories. We're now calling them. They take a lot of investment. How on this continent do we get the fair share of that investment? So we can bring the benefit of this technology. I mean, beyond that, into Absa, what's taking my time at the moment, clearly a new group CEO, Kenny, joined us last June. Altogether, the group executive, we've redefined the group strategy. That translates into a change, obviously, in terms of what technology, digital data, and AI must deliver. And, of course, positioning everything we do in support of that strategy takes an awful lot of my time. I'm known for long answers, so I hope I've answered, given you a sense as to what's top of mind right now.
Oh, perfect. I want to spend quite a bit of time, actually, maybe a bit later in this conversation, talking about the impact of AI in banking and yes. on business, actually more broadly than that. But you mentioned Kenny Fichtler and his appointment as Group's CEO, and the change in strategy, and something we covered on Tech Central. I think it was a couple of months ago now, was the it was detailed in, I think, in your 2025 financial year results, where you accelerated the write down of your yes. Software assets. I think it was an amount of 2.4 billion rand impairment on software, which was a 13-fold increase on the prior year's write off, and that was in the year to December 2025.
Yes,
you at the same time announced an acceleration to AI. And cloud investment. But maybe just take us through what the strategic thinking was behind that impairment and what it means for the bank.
Yeah, this is a question I get asked a fair bit. So when we, when we step back, like any bank of our size, we make significant investments in technology. I think that's a statement of the obvious. It's about a quarter of our operating expense every year. You know, what we really did this year was recognize really three things. I mean, the first is we have had a fundamental shift in our group strategy. You know, so we're very clear we now operate Pan-African. So we now have three Pan-African business units. That's a change from how we operated if I've been speaking to you 12 months ago. So clearly, in terms of how you think about technology and technology investments and the customer experience we want to deliver, whether it's in Ghana on the west or Kenya, you know, on the east or here in South Africa, those are really important considerations. So the pivot to our new group strategy, which focuses on client-led growth, which focuses on Pan-African diversification, which focuses on excellence, and then also focuses on these new growth opportunities that clearly the bank needs to get into and be successful in, really is the first dimension that caused us to reflect on the current assets on our that we had in the bank. The second is regulation, of course, is constantly changing. And there were some assets where regulation had moved on. And again, you know, it was still on the intangible asset. And then the third, which is what you hinted at, and I think we all realize this in our daily lives, the rate at which technology is changing these days. And the three I always pick on to explain to my stakeholders, AI, which we all appreciate. None of us had heard of ChatGPT until November 2022. And then, you know, 3 months later, 100 million people were using it, over a billion or something now. And that's just one example. I should say many more do exist. Data, obviously, the rate at which the infrastructures for data is also changing power in AI. And then the other area, which is quite a big area, is cybersecurity. And again, in the technology space, we all understand this. What was state of the art even 24 months ago in cybersecurity versus today? So those would be the three major reasons that drove our deep reflection. I have said internally, clearly every year you look at your assets on the book. Sadly, you don't do that scale regularly. But given a very fundamental change in group strategy, the fact that some investments, the regulatory regime had changed, and then in some investments, you know, 3 to 5 years ago, you expected an asset to last you 5 years. In reality, you appreciate your change. And I suppose underneath that is a shift more towards a service-based approach, you know, where you consume services. So those, at a macro level, were the three reasons. In our case, there wasn't a single big asset. I know that's a question I've also been asked. You know, was there a single big asset that you had to? I mean, just to give you a sense, there were well over 100 different small assets that, when we looked at, made up that number.
It's incredible how technology and banking has changed over the years. I'm going to give away my age a bit here, but I remember in the mid-1990s, probably around 94, 95, visiting Absa at your head office in downtown Johannesburg and going down into the basement and seeing this water-cooled mainframe sitting there, taking up a vast amount of space. It connected to more racks of tape backup systems, and that was the bank humming away then. I think you had a duplicate of it in Randburg somewhere. And I remember going back to that same data center, I think maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, actually I think it was a bit further back than that, but it had all shrunk down into an IBM Z series mainframe sitting in the corner of this vast empty space. And of course, I mean, I don't even know if that mainframe's sitting there anymore as everyone moves to the cloud.
I can answer that question. We still have a Z16 mainframe, one in Randburg, one in Samrand. They're much, much smaller today. At the same time, there's the mainframe. I also saw a quantum computer the other week with IBM. And again, this is just the, you know, the reality you understand. And I mean, I think, frankly, the mainframe, I say to people, the issue is not the mainframe. It's kept evolving. You know, mainframes have generative AI chips on them today. The issue is the software you wrote 40 years ago for banking 40 years ago.
In COBOL.
And, you know, whether I run that on a mainframe or I run that on the cloud, it's still got the mental paradigm of banking 40 years ago. So, of course, a lot of our challenge is, on the one hand, you've got that. On the other hand, I could show you technology. We used Cloud Code to, you know, help us write twice as quickly. And that's just the reality when you're a bank like Absa.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's all happened in a matter of a couple of decades. So who knows what the future of banking is going to look like.
I've also started working in the 90s, and when I just think of the pace of technology change, I mean, I can honestly say in the past 3 to 5 years, it's never changed this quickly. And I would have said that, you know, when cloud came out 10 or so years ago, we'd have said that in the early 2000s when it was the internet. But literally month in, month out now, the rate of change is accelerating. Of course, in any organization, the question then is, how do you become adept at using that change to deliver your business strategy, deliver your customer promises? So there's a level of agility, you know, that you really need to build. And that starts really with your mindset. Your technology is a different thing, but your mindset and how you think becomes really quite important.
But that must be challenging. I mean, a bank is a very large, very regulated, very process-driven organization. How do you as a technology leader instill that more creative thinking and that, the world is changing rapidly? You've got new competitors emerging who, you'll never need to buy a mainframe. How do you as an organization adapt in this world that's just moving more and more quickly?
That clearly is a challenge. I always start by saying it's first and foremost a way of thinking and it's a mindset. Some things endure. Customers trust their bank. It's really important. And that's everything from the ethics with which you operate, how responsible you are, but clearly also just to the basics of information security. Those things... What you need to do stays the same. The speed at which you need to respond, of course, keeps changing, and therefore your mindset needs to think of that. We do live in banking is regulated, rightly so. Life sciences are regulated, rightly so. But again, even how you think about, and I'm going to use a technical word, codifying your processes becomes very, very important. So, you know, a lot of the challenge is I design processes based on my paradigm of 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when it was paper-based. If you just think differently, you get the same level of responsibility, but, you can do it differently. So it's actually, first and foremost, I say people are mindset challenge. You need people who can think differently, that are not locked into your existing paradigms and think that's the only solution, which is why I encourage people to spend a lot of time networking with peer banks. There are the banks built in the past 5 to 10 years, digital banks, we call them. Their stack is new. But the same regulation would apply to them. You still have FICA, KYC, etc. So thinking differently is important. Networking is important. And then I think also one of the challenges is sometimes becomes all too big. If you think at the macro level, you know, how do you transform an entire bank? It gets very complex very, very quickly. So you need people, again, who have this much more within guardrails, and those are very, very important. We'll probably come on to talk about AI and guardrails, I'm sure. But you need guardrails within which you allow people a freedom to act. So you know you're operating within regulation, within your own principles as a bank, but within that construct, you give people. And then you just need to be intolerant of lots of things in large corporations have happened over time, and people don't go back and question, why do we still do it this way? And again, you need people who can question that. So a lot of the limitation I say to people is, yes, technology is technology. And, on the one hand, I'd admit something I wrote 40 years ago when I opened my branches, probably from 9 till 3 versus today when I need to be open 24/7. Different paradigm, but you need people who can think differently, challenge differently. And then the final thing I'll close on is you must be clear why you're doing it. And that takes you back to your strategy and your customers. Because when you look through a lot of that, much of the complexity organizations have built actually falls away. And, you can automate lots of things and simplify lots of things. So I haven't got, the one-line answer, but there's certainly techniques I do think large organizations use, which help them be a lot more responsive. And the thing I find interesting is I say to people, any organization more than 10 years old now has legacy technology. Sounds a bit strange to say, but You know, if you were to start a digital bank in 2026 versus in 2015, you would just start from a very different point of departure in terms of the technology that you would leverage. Yeah.
Stuff becomes legacy more and more quickly as time advances, it seems, yeah.
Yeah.
Just allied to that, I actually wanted to ask you what, I mean, you employ thousands and thousands of people in the IT function as an organization. How do you encourage your talent to keep pace? And you know, the world's changing AI. I'm sure a lot of developers in your organization are using it already or watching it, perhaps even worried that the whole field of software development is going to be taken over by machines at some point. How do you manage it from a staffing perspective, this rapid rate of change?
So I would say the two or three things that we do. I mean, first and foremost, leadership matters an awful lot. So the poise of leadership, the messages we give are critically important. So we've clearly got to encourage our colleagues to adopt. So if you were to join a town hall, people are bored with Johnson talking about AI and quantum and where it's going. And please, I encourage you to be curious. I use words like that. The second is you have to look for your early adopters, and you have to protect them, and you have to give them some limelight. You know, so with a lot of our principal engineers, it's one of the terms we use. This is one thing we do quite deliberately, because again, it's one thing Johnson talking about Claude Code or GitHub Copilot or any of these tools. It's quite another thing when your fellow practitioner is talking about it and is a strong advocate. And to create these advocates, we do quite deliberate things, you know, events we ask them to attend, how we celebrate as they certify. So again, if you join one of our town halls, you will find every single town hall, there's some celebration. You know, this person has achieved this, this person has done that. So in a way, we gamify it, but it's to reinforce what we encourage and what we value. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, of course, is to demystify and take away fear. So I'm very clear, you know, we've zero ambition to be reducing the number of people in tech. We've got the opposite problem in technology. We've had it for decades. We can't get enough skills in AI, in data, in cybersecurity, in software engineering. So we really just encourage everyone to keep current. The final thing I would say that we are doing with a lot of our colleagues is don't associate your identity with a piece of technology. I wouldn't name any piece of technology, but today it may have been vendor A. Mm. Tomorrow it's vendor B. What we really value is the fact that you're committed to UPSA, you're committed to our purpose, you care about our customers, and then you use whatever technology best helps. And that's a shift, I would say, in my working life. Because for ever so long, you know, you bought a platform and you ran it for 10 or 15 years and you became an expert in platform X and that kind of became your identity. So that's the other thing we do quite a lot, try and say, accept the underlying technology is probably going to change a fair bit.
Mm. It does seem that one of the greatest skills to have in this new era we're heading into is the ability to adapt quickly.
Yes.
And not be stuck on one technology or one skill or that sort of thing. Yeah. It seems to cross-cut across industries as well. It's probably a good time, Johnson, to maybe start to talk a little bit more about the AI side of things, because there is so much going on there. I wanted to get your views on the noise around Anthropic's Mythos model, which has not been released to the public yet, but has been given to a number of large U.S. banks and a few other organizations, and I think to the U.S. government as well. There have been suggestions that this is Anthropic hyping it up and marketing it through a fear strategy, but there also does seem to be some genuine concern that this model is able to find bugs and security vulnerabilities in software and systems that human beings simply weren't aware was there. How worried are you as the technology leader of a large bank about where, not necessarily just Mythos, but future AI models are going from a cybersecurity perspective? And are we heading for Armageddon here?
You'll have seen my face probably went solemn for a few seconds there. So I'd say a few things. This is clearly fast-moving technology. The answer I give to our board and to our executive is we will use AI to counter adversaries who use AI. That's the answer I give. So just as tools like Mythos come out, and I'm sure there are other large language models with similar or soon-to-be similar capabilities, essentially what we will end up doing, and I had a discussion with Anthropic specifically on this, is essentially we will have super agents that use the same technology to do the scanning and vulnerability management ourselves. And then, of course, the rate at which a company like ourselves patches these vulnerabilities is also going to have to increase. So it sounds quite simplistic, but is it serious? Yes. Every organization should pay attention. Shouldn't panic. I don't advocate panicking. Understand the capability and understand that adversaries will get hold of these tools and they will use them. Organizations like ourselves absolutely also must do the same. And we obviously have to be very adept at using them. So again, back to your question on skills and how do we encourage our staff. It's part of the reason why we invest so much. So is this a topic, you know, that's got board attention and executive attention in APSA? Yes. I think anyone in any large bank would tell you the same. We have spent a lot of time with Anthropic themselves, with key partners as well who are in the, you know, the project, the consortium. And our takeout is, yes, it's very good at finding additional vulnerabilities. Organizations will use tools like it to find and remediate also very quickly. And that is the cycle time that one needs to get used to. And the only way of doing it will be to be very adept at leveraging AI.
Should models like this be made available to the public immediately, or do you think there's an argument maybe that large organizations and then filtering down into other companies should get access to this technology first to fix problems, and only then does it become generally available at some point in the future?
That's a very, very good question. I can see pros and cons both ways. The particular company we're talking about has got a particular emphasis on responsible AI and safe AI. And I do think that's why they've adopted this approach. You know, not all of the AI companies, and they're the AI companies we all know about. And of course, there will be countries working on AI that you don't know about. They will clearly just release them. So I think what is really important is organizations like ourselves are at the forefront of all of this, whether it's from this company or any other company. And your response, your sense and response needs to be a lot quicker. At the end of the day, this is becoming democratized. So at the end of the day, the speed at which it gets from development into the hands of ultimately consumers is just going to get shorter and shorter and shorter. And I think, you know, for an organization like ourselves, broadening it out from this model, you know, which is particularly good at finding vulnerabilities and therefore could be used negatively, I do think the transformative power of this technology is something you really want in the hands of consumers as quickly as possible. When you think about its ability to create jobs, drive economic growth, when you think about the skills that come with this kind of technology, the macro level, you kind of think it's unfair to just limit it to companies in one country or to one country or to. So I think it's, you raise one of these questions that for which there's no right or wrong answer. There'll be lots of opinions. But on the whole, the transformative nature of this technology and getting it in the hands of, in our case, customers in the African continent and, the general population and using it for good while protecting against people who try and use it for, bad or negative consequences is very important.
I suppose ultimately it's something that policymakers and regulators are going to have to grapple with.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm sure.
I do hope in the African continent, one of the things we actually get better at quickly is, moving on regulation and collaboration on regulation across our 50 plus countries on the continent. because I think that would be, again, a great driver of adoption and economic growth from the benefit that can come.
Certainly, the South African Reserve Bank and its related or affiliate regulators seems to be on top of a lot of these
issues.
But I suppose from a Pan-African perspective, there may be some challenges still. One concern that's been raised a lot now, I'd be keen to get your view on this, is the impact of AI on jobs. Particularly in the developer space, there's been a lot of talk that a lot of the basic development work is going to be done by AI going forward, and that these tools in the hands of senior developers with years or decades of experience are going to make them incredibly productive and able to do the work that, you know, two or three or four juniors could have done in the past. But there's a concern now being expressed that that as a lot of this more basic coding work becomes automated and done by AIs, that there isn't going to be a demand anymore for junior developers, and that that this may disappear as a career option for many people. But then that's going to leave a challenge where the senior developers are eventually going to retire and disappear from these organizations. Is everything then going to be run by computers and automated, or is there a future for software developers? Where are we going with this? Do you have a take on this? Be keen to hear your view.
This is purely an opinion at a point in time. I've been lucky. Technology has given me a phenomenal career. So I still encourage people to come into technology as a career. I think of the change in my working life. You know, it's hard to imagine what it'd be like in 20, 30 years. So I'm certainly not sitting here saying we won't need developers, we won't need people in technology. I think it will change what's required. On the point you raised, this is something actually we are spending quite a bit of time thinking about. And the metaphor, or maybe not metaphor is the wrong word, the picture that's emerging in my mind is, you know, we used to have these hierarchical junior, mid-level, senior developer, and you grow. I'm moving more towards probably what we'll end up with is kind of apprenticeships. You will have your more junior developers working alongside your senior developers right together as a way of accelerating their expertise. I'm only speaking on technology as of today, so it could be completely a different capability in 2 to 3 years. But, you know, we still absolutely value people who understand APSA, understand our customers. The experience that is built up, without being disrespectful to AI, is not something that AI yet gives you the benefit of. But certainly our thought process has moved from, you know, maybe you had a pyramid and, you know, you brought X in and you'd four and then you moved to that, more to perhaps what you'll end up with is more these kind of apprenticeship type models, where you're growing skill that way. Lots of people have told me, and we've seen it ourselves, the more experienced developers get more value from these tools, absolutely. So we're going to have to rethink, I agree, but I'm not sitting here thinking it means we will, a CIO like myself will sit here anytime soon and say, I've got more than enough technology skills, I've got more than enough cyber skills. I personally think that's in the near term not very likely. When you just think about how pervasive this is becoming, it's in everything, it's everywhere. So it's just expanding, you know, really quite exponentially. You need people who know how to use the technology to achieve the outcomes you want.
I do like to ask my guests on the show what attracted them to the technology industry in the first place. You say you've been in this field for 40 years. What did you always aspire to get into computers? What interested you in tech in the first place?
Start life. I said I always aspired to be in computers. When I was a very young child, I wanted to be an airline pilot. So if you'd asked the 10, 13-year-old Johnson, he wanted to be an airline pilot. And then he started to appreciate that aircraft were become flying computers. So this is in the mid-1980s. And then he did something called avionics, which is basically IT for computers. And then, he decided the the aeronautical side was far less interesting than the computer side. And the rest is history, so to speak. I then started with what's now Accenture and then AstraZeneca, you've mentioned, etc. Mm-hmm. However, what I've really come to love, I suppose, about my career, for a more serious note, is there is a technology, absolutely. But what you do with the technology and how you bring strategy, vision to life and how you impact, you know, positively in your customers' lives, how you see colleagues growing and building careers, how in a little way in countries like ours you're building skills. It's kind of what's kept me in it. But yeah, that was my slide into technology. First of all, more mechanical side, then realizing aircraft were becoming flying computers, and then so here I am in APSA.
What was your first computer, out of interest?
A BBC Basic, if you remember those. Okay.
I remember the name. I don't think I ever used one. It was a British computer.
Yes, it was a British. So I grew up in Nigeria. I'm part Scottish, part Nigerian. So I did my primary education in Nigeria. And when I went back to the UK, those were the computers you bought and used. It was either an Atari or a BBC. I'm now showing my age. Those are two brands.
I do remember the Atari. I don't think the BBCs were ever sold in South Africa, but they sold the ZX, the ZX81 and the ZX Spectrum.
Yes, they were quite popular.
And around the same time, I think, and the Commodore, of course, which was
That's my vintage.
Mine too. now we're talking to AI chatbots. So the world has certainly changed in the last 40 years. But just steering the conversation back to AI, I wanted to just get a view from you on where this is going. I think the big talking point now is agentic AI, and I know Absa is doing some interesting stuff in the space with, I think it's Agent Force from Salesforce. So you're exposing this technology to customers as well. Maybe just take us through what your thinking is around deploying agentic AI inside APSA, what you've done so far, and what you think the technology is going to be capable of.
Yeah, I mean, we're working with a number of partners looking at their agentic AI capabilities. You've mentioned one. There are certainly others. Again, I try and demystify a lot of this when I speak to colleagues. To me, a lot of this is really very intelligent automation, and I'm dumbing it down deliberately to demystify it. So obviously, the organization you mentioned is a big partner of ours. So of course, when they released Agent Force, we were a very early adopter. We have been very clear, and I think we've said this quite publicly, any AI implementation we have, and I'm now talking generative AI, agentic AI, there's a human in the loop. We are very clear that there just isn't enough experience of this technology at the moment to, particularly when you're dealing with customers, to take the human out of the loop. So we've been very, very clear about that. And you know, in our principles as to how we use this technology, that's front and center. What we're doing at the moment is really using it to ensure there's convenience. You know, so in the customer field, Abby, which is our AI agent in our app, you know, has got some LLM capability behind it. Obviously, most of the interactions are out after hours. So again, from a customer point of view, but it's not making decisions. It's not. It's more an assistant. I'll give you an example of something we've done internally. Every organization like ourselves, for our colleagues. So this is an example for our colleagues. There are certain days of the month when there's a long queue outside your technology bar. We call them a tech bar, but a technology support center in any of your buildings. There's a long queue, password resets, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we've built an agent to help. Since we released it last August, I think 11,000 colleagues have interacted with this agent. It's built up quite a knowledge base. It's resolving 90% of their queries there and then. The satisfaction from colleagues is 90% plus. So what does that do? You're a colleague. You don't have to stand for 15 minutes in a line at a particular time waiting for an IT person to help you. Or in IT terms, you know, I'm not having to put more and more people onto a tech bar, you know, when an agent is perfectly capable of helping. So we're finding lots of those quite small use cases where, you know, literally 80% of queries, questions you can address, you can resolve using these tools. And then obviously when you have, in this case, an IT person really dealing with a colleague, it's in something, you know, more of an edge case. And then you keep just iterating on that. You know, what we're impressed by is the speed at which you can deploy these things. It's weeks, it's not months. Which also means if it doesn't work, you shut it down and you move on to the next one. We haven't had to shut anything down now, but, you know, obviously you watch the adoption. And there will come a point in time when you say, actually, adoption is dropping off. Therefore, you need to evolve. Maybe to get back to the point, you know, you can foresee a world where you will have these AI agents almost as humans. They will appear like humans in doing certain tasks, and you will bound those tasks. I do think one of the things that's evolved since agentic AI came out is initially it was all just the probabilistic LLMs. Now you see some determinism coming in. So don't stray to this area or that area to avoid, you know, hallucinations and things like that. So you can now guide them a lot better than you could. So I think in time, you know, you'll have agents working for humans, etc., doing particular tasks. And obviously they'll be able to do it at the speed, as a human, I couldn't. So again, it's early days. Let me not overstate it, and let me not pretend there are hundreds of these agents and apps that there aren't. But some of these early use cases, you can begin to see how very practically they can make a difference, help you with speed, help you with satisfaction, be there when, you know, your contact center, you know, can't answer, I need this, where do I find it kind of thing.
Yeah. You mentioned AI doing work for humans. I don't know if you've seen that there's now a website where human beings can volunteer their services.
Yes. To AIs. I've noticed that.
And I mentioned this to a couple of colleagues who immediately signed up and made their services available. So one does wonder where the future of humanity is going if we volunteering to provide all our services to machines so quickly. Interesting times ahead. But it's been fantastic chatting to you, Johnson. It's it's always nice to talk to a fellow technologist. And 40 years from now, who knows what this world and this industry.
4 years from now.
Banking. 40 years from now. When we're both retired and hopefully still alive, we can look back and and marvel at what happened in our lifetimes. But Johnson Idiso is a group CITO at APSA. Thank you very much for your time on Tech Central's Meet the CIO and for making the time to chat with us today.
Been a pleasure.